WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Welcome to WrestleSpective Radio at fairtoflare.com. My name is Jason Mann, and today we are talking about the main event of Starrcade 1987, NWA Champion Ron Garvin against the challenger Ric Flair. And my very special guest today, he is Rick, and he's also known as the Mass Tweeter on Twitter. And a fantastic wrestling fan, really excited to have him on the show. Rick, how are you doing today?
I'm fine, and thank you very much for having me on the show.
You're very welcome. And definitely one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show is because you definitely have a unique perspective on Ron Garvin that I bet a lot of the listeners and other wrestling fans don't have. And why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, about your experiences with Ron Garvin?
Sure. So I got to know Ron Garvin when he came to Montreal in 1985, summer of 1985. He teamed up with his brother, Jimmy Garvin, son-in-law, Jimmy Garvin, but storyline brother, and they feuded with the Rougeau brothers throughout the summer of 85, and
Yeah, and I mean, and that was a really hot feud during that time, you know, in Montreal. I mean, obviously the Rougeaus were really, you know, for people who only know the Rougeaus, you know, from their WWF days. I mean, they were, you know, I mean, they were it in Montreal. I mean, they were the, you know, the you know, kind of like the Jerry Lawler of Memphis. They were kind of like that in Montreal, correct?
Right. I mean, this feud with the Garvins really put them over the top, and eventually they moved on in 86 to the WWE.
Right.
Certainly the feud got started on Saint-Jean-Baptiste Day, June 24th, which is a very nationalistic holiday here in Quebec. So when the Garvin brothers came in, they blindsided Jacques Rougeau, sprayed some aerosol air freshener, and Precious did spray some aerosol freshener, air room freshener in Jacques Rougeau Jr.'s eyes. Then that led Ronnie Garvin beat him up. Then they double teamed Raymond Rougeau, and the father, Jacques Rougeau Sr., got involved as well. He got taken down as well by the Garvin brothers, and that started the feud for the rest of the summer.
So of course, you know, most of the fans watching the Starrcade 87 weren't really aware of that, but they, you know, Ron had sort of, I know he worked nationally in Georgia some in the 80s, obviously had worked in Crockett. He and Flair had had some matches before, but he was definitely kind of a mid-level wrestler at this point. Kind of was inserted into the feud after Flair had feuded with Jimmy Garvin. Jimmy Garvin, also kind of a mid-level wrestler, but that was kind of an interesting feud because, you know, it was all about Flair going after Jimmy Garvin's wife or manager. I don't know if they acknowledged they were husband and wife. They probably did, but Precious. And, of course, Jimmy Garvin had kind of throughout the 80s been sort of like the flamboyant, you know, he'd been world class. He'd been in the AWA. He'd, you know, been in different places and was, you know, kind of the, you know, the lecherous kind of, you know, gigolo kind of thing. And, you know, the kind of did the same thing that a lot of guys did with the valets back during that time. So it was interesting for him to kind of be the good guy now. In fact, he became a good guy after Ron had, you know, been injured. I think he was beaten up by the Horsemen or maybe another gang of fields. But
yeah, the Midnight Express, they threw fire in his eye.
That's right. Yes, it was Cornette. That's right. That's right. I recently saw that. I forgot it was a Midnight Express. And then Garvin, you know, Jimmy got involved. Then we had the Jimmy Flair. Then that later became Jimmy Flair. And then Ron comes back. And then we got, you know, eventually Ron and Flair. And let me tell you, Garvin's championship reign is not well remembered. He's kind of thought of, you know, very much a transition, not really even transitional because Flair won it back, but you know, it lasted about 60 days. I think he went on some sort of sabbatical during that time, or there was something weird about where he didn't defend the title for a while.
I read a whole bunch of different things about that, where, you know, he was getting booed in the arenas, so they didn't make him defend the title or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know how much credence I put in on that.
I'm not sure. I don't know the exact circumstances either, but I know that honestly, that at the time it was considered kind of a disaster, and that they put and then, you know, they gave it to Flair back at Starrcade, which I think was the plan the entire time. But I mean, as far as the matches go, and, you know, just artistically, I mean, Garvin and Flair had something special. I mean, they really just brought the best out of each other. I mean, the work was really tight and stiff and just looked like a heavyweight fight. And, I mean, this match is really, I think it's a pretty fantastic match. It's kind of lost in the shuffle of some of the better Starrcade matches. And I think it's up there. It's not quite at the level of Race or, you know, Vader, you know, Flair, those, but it's close. And I think that, in preparing for this, I came across the Garvin Flair match where Garvin won the title in Detroit.
Yes.
And that match and that moment is incredible. I mean, it, you know, it eclipses this, which this is also very good, but that is just, you know, tremendous. I mean, I really love the Garvin Flair, you know, series of matches. I mean, you know, maybe it wasn't a success, you know, like I said, from a commercial perspective, but artistically, it's some pretty damn good stuff.
Yeah, the one where the match where Garvin won the title was actually definitely a better match than the Starrcade one, but the Starrcade one as well, I think, can hold its own with the other Flair matches.
Definitely. So we're in Chicago, Chi-Town Heat, kind of Chicago. Putting Starrcade 87 in Chicago was kind of a controversial decision. It was the first time. It had been in Greensboro every year since 83, and then in 85 and 86 they had dual shows, Atlanta and Greensboro, where they kind of went back and forth. And moving it from Chicago was definitely something that made the Greensboro people very mad and really hurt that town, which was, you know, one of their centerpiece towns, maybe indeed their centerpiece town. And then this show, although I, you know, it's really, you know, there's a lot of exciting stuff on this show, particularly this main event, but the sort of an infamous Road Warriors Horseman match, which is a good match, but ends with another silly, you know, what they call a dusty finish,
yeah,
you know, a false finish where it looks like the Road Warriors have won the title, but then a second referee comes in and, you know, Arnor Telly got thrown over the top rope or whatever, which really made the fans mad and hurt them in Chicago as well. So it was kind of a double whammy of kind of bad decisions. And I think, you know, Crockett, they were trying to expand to compete with WWF, and they had high contracts and they weren't able to keep up with the money and made some other bad decisions, and kind of definitely the repetitive, you know, of the good guys getting screwed type finishes really, I think, you know, the all those things ended up hurting them, and then they ended up, you know, selling to Ted Turner sometime in 88. But it's still, I mean, this is really, I look back at these Starrcades, and these are fun shows to watch. I mean, they really are.
Well, yes, then Starrcade 87, I mean, where they were also integrating the UWF stars at the time.
Yes.
They recently taken over Bill Watts' UWF territory.
Yeah.
So we have some good matches and some good wrestlers in there.
Yeah, and that's how they got Sting. You know, Sting was part of the UWF crew, and then he came in as it was a bad guy first, but quickly turned into a good guy. And then, of course, a few months after this, has the very famous first match with the Clash of Champions match with Flair that really put him on the map. So, yeah, interesting transition time. And really, I mean, this is, you know, 87. Pretty much after 87, all that's left that are really nationally relevant are Crockett and WWF.
Right.
You know, I mean, everything, UWF dies, World Class was, you know, on its last legs, you know, and, you know, Florida really wasn't relevant for a while. AWA was still going, but they were, you know, pretty much fading. I don't think they were quite as horrible as they would later get, but they were still, you know, they were almost done, that kind of thing. So it's interesting, the dynamic of Flair as the challenger here, which he was the challenger obviously in 83, but he had been the champion for so long. I mean, there were slight interruptions, you know, Dusty won it, you know, there were some, you know, Kerry Von Erich won it, but it was always, you know, 30 days or less he would lose it, and then the other guy would, you know, then he would get it back. So
right.
I mean, he was almost uninterrupted as champion, you know, since 83, really, even back into 81. That race, you know, that race reign was 6 months. So I mean, he was, you know, firmly established as champion for the, you know, previous 6 years or so. So seeing him come in here as the guy trying to win it was sort of interesting. And the crowd is definitely behind, or there, you know, there's more cheers for Flair than there are for Garvin. Garvin isn't booed overwhelmingly or anything, but he's, you know, it's definitely a pro Flair crowd, particularly when Flair wins the title back.
I thought it was definitely split down the middle early on in the match. I think Garvin was getting his cheers as well during his offense.
Sure.
But around the 10-minute mark, I noticed that it was really turning towards Flair, who the crowd was.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know if there's any particular thing they did in the work. There were a number of Garvin gets some near falls and Flair kicks out of them. So maybe kind of the fighting spirit, for lack of a better term, that Flair was showing. There's no, you know, horseman shenanigans here, which is kind of interesting. You know, I mean, you know, Flair's definitely Flair, but he's not over the top villain in this match, really.
No, I think Garvin is more the villain. In a sense, I mean, he was biting Flair at one point.
That's true. That's a good point. Yeah.
Doing a lot of things that, you know, you wouldn't expect. And Flair actually was the one bleeding, which is interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. That's also a good point. So, commentary here, Jim Ross makes his Starrcade debut along with Tony Schiavone. It's just weird to hear Jim Ross's voice because it's so different in 1987 than it is in 2011. I mean, it's almost like a different person.
Yeah. Well, 24 years ago, right?
So. Yeah, well, yeah, but it's, you know, you don't think mentally of a guy's voice changing that much, but, you know, I mean, I guess when you're a broadcaster doing that for a living, it's going to a certain extent, and obviously he changed his style to fit what WWF, WWE wanted out of him as well, so. I like this commentary crew. I've mentioned before, but I think Tony Schiavone pre-Nitro was very good for the most part as a commentator.
Yeah, I had no issues with Tony Schiavone whenever I would hear him.
Yeah, yeah. I think the thing that stands out as far as the match goes, I mean, just the way these guys hit each other, just how hard they hit each other with, you know, punches and kicks and elbows. And Garvin's favorite strike is a slap, but his slaps are really hard to the chest. I mean, the trading the slaps and the chops, I mean, it's just, it's grand. I mean, it really is good stuff.
Yeah, Garvin has been known to work quite stiff. Certainly he kept that up in this match.
Yeah, I think Flair and Garvin really kind of brought the best. I mean, certainly Flair brought the best out of Garvin. I've never seen Garvin in a, you know, I think he was a good wrestler and fun to watch, but I never saw anything, you know, Garvin in matches that were that at this level with anyone else. I don't know if the matches with the Garvins and the Rougeaus, I mean, obviously that was a heated thing. Looking back on it, you know, with more of a critical eye than you probably did at the time, do those stand out as, I mean, would you recommend those be something that, you know, a wrestling fan today check out?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, just the whole storyline, the emotion and also the fans were, you know, obviously very pro Rougeau during the whole feud. They had some great matches. A lot of them ended in disqualification with the Rougeaus getting disqualified in most of the matches, leading up to, you know, the final Loser Leave Town match in August, which was a, if I remember correctly, a bit of a, it wasn't a bloodbath, but there was certainly some blood in it. And it was pretty violent in that respect.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, we have Flair does get a low blow early, kind of cutting off, Garvin, who was beating him up pretty good, gets an atomic drop. Then we have a lot of woos when Flair's on offense, kind of the, kind of part where, you know, you might be seeing the fans getting behind Flair a little bit. This is still pretty early in the match. We work him over with hard chops in the corner. And one thing I love is when an opponent is more like Flair's equal, like a Garvin or a Steamboat, where you don't get the whole, like, I'm going to suddenly no-sell Flair's chops and punches and stuff and elbows, because Flair looks, I mean, you know, his blows are so good. They look like they hurt so much that you just kind of feel like it really kind of takes you out of it when, you know, like a Luger or a Sting or a Koloff or later a Hogan kind of just shrugs it off like it's nothing.
Right.
And it's more enjoyable for me to see, you know, kind of, and it, I don't know, makes when the good guy overcomes what Flair is doing, it kind of makes it seem more like a challenge, like he's accomplished something greater, you know? So, I enjoy that very much. So we have Flair working over the knee, going to work, gets the knee breaker and the figure four. Works the ropes, but as Ross and Shivani mentioned a lot, it's no disqualification match, no time limit either. So, and they're in a cage. So, this is kind of for all the marbles. Although the Garvin win was in a cage as well. I don't know if they were just really cage happy this year or if that just was a coincidence or what have you. But definitely, and they used the cage very well. Although they do wait a while before they really use the cage. I mean, they have Flair tries not long after the figure four, after Garvin turns it over, we have Flair trying to slam Garvin into the cage, but Ron blocking it, and then eventually Flair tries to toss him into it, but then Garvin reverses the whip and then sends him into the cage and kind of sends him into it repeatedly and then grates his face into it. So
yeah.
Kind of thing that you bring up with Garvin being more of, you know, kind of the bad guy here. I think that's a good observation.
And this is where it's around this point where I think the fans actually start turning on Garvin as well.
Yeah.
And you start hearing a lot of Garvin sucks chants at this point.
Yeah. They were subtle, but you could definitely hear them. And you did not hear a whole lot of, you know, this guy sucks, especially a good guy sucks in 87. I mean, that was pretty right. Unheard of. So, so after that, we have Flair trying to go to the top, sort of trying to escape, although you couldn't win the cage match by escaping because they didn't have stupid rules like WWF did at the time about that. They both end up at the top rope. We have, Flair's head being knocked off the steel, and then Garvin sort of teases trying the sunset flip, which is what won him the title a few months before, but Farrah kind of falls away and you know, gets away with it. And I liked how they incorporated a lot of the stuff from the first match into this match.
Yeah, it seemed that for the most part Garvin was doing a lot of the same moves from that September match where he won the title, but in the case of the Starrcade match, Flair was able to almost like Flair was reading him and was able to reverse a lot of those moves that he did in the first match.
Yeah, and that kind of plays into the finish a little bit too. You know, kind of Flair being able to outsmart Garvin, even though, you know, Garvin's just really giving him a ferocious beating throughout most of it. You know, I mean, they both get their licks in certainly, but. So after that, Flair ends up trying to go to the top. Garvin sends him off it and then gets his own figure four. And I love the ability the agony that Flair conveys when he's in this figure four. I mean, nobody did that better than Flair.
Yeah.
And he eventually gets to the ropes, which Tommy Young breaks, which is sort of weird because it's the no DQ. But I guess sort of the idea that if you're in the ropes, you know, you kind of have to get out of them. I mean, you can't just kind of be in the rope. So I am willing. I mean, they were willing to break it. So I'm willing to overlook that sure. Sort of thing. I mean, it's different if, you know, if the one guy's using the ropes to its advantage, then, you know, I wouldn't say you would break it there, but the other way, sure.
Yeah. It's even like when Flair was in the figure four or when Flair was putting the figure four on Garvin, he was actually, when the referee wasn't looking, you know, getting some leverage off the ropes as well. And when the referee would turn around, he would let go. So, they were definitely, even though it was non-DQ, they were still kind of following the rules, so to speak.
Yeah, and I mean, I think even, you know, Shivani and Ross kind of mentioned that, where, like, where you know, Young's there to make the count, but he's also there to, you know, he still wants this to be, he wants to encourage the wrestlers to be as fair and as sporting as possible, because that's kind of what a good referee would do. I mean, even though, yeah, you're able to break the rules, I want to encourage you not to. So I don't know, that would be my logic to it, but it doesn't, none of that upset me as far as hurting the match or anything like that.
No, no, no.
It wasn't like it was like, huh, you know, it like it puzzled me or anything. So then we have Garvin doing more to work on the leg. We have a lot of vicious slaps and chops being traded throughout. Again, we have Flair trying to run Garvin in the cage, but Garvin reversing it. Then he gets some of the really good near falls. He does a crossbody off the top that gets to a backslide that gets to, and then he more raking Flair's face into the cage. Slaps Flair, and Flair's kind of hanging off the ropes, and then he slaps him, and then Flair's falling back into the cage, just really getting it beaten out of him. I mean, really, really, just rugged stuff. They both end up at the top of the cage where they battle there, and then Garvin headbutts Flair, which he ends up crotching himself on the ropes. That's when they do the sunset flip, but in this time, Flair's able to hold onto the ropes to hold Garvin down. But then Tommy breaks Flair's lock on the ropes, but it only gets two anyway. Which was, you know, some inventive stuff. And then, you know, Flair being able to escape all of this offense was, I mean, these are pretty dramatic moves for 1987. You know, when obviously, you know, today guys will hit a million finishers and kick out of a million finishers, but you didn't really see that as much back then. And we weren't really as finisher reliant in 1987, particularly. You know, WWE was more that way, but, you know, NWA and some of the other territories, it wasn't like guys had as much in their signature finisher, I would say.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. And then we have Garvin trying to do the 10 punches in the corner, but Flair manages to get inverted atomic drop. And Tommy's sort of in the way. I think he gets knocked down a bit. And that actually enables Garvin to get his Hands of Stone punch, which I love the Hands of Stone thing. Like, Garvin had a really good looking punch, and it was kind of cool because Garvin didn't punch all the time. Like we said before, he does more of the slaps as his mode of offense, which look really stiff, but then when he gets that punch in, it really has some impact, you know?
Right. Yeah, he would use it to set up certain moves like the Garvin Stomp and as well, right? So
yeah, but he used the punch rarely enough that when he hit the punch, it made it meaningful, you know? Right. Where guys, you know, they kind of, I mean, wrestling used to have a thing where you weren't allowed to punch. I mean, that was kind of one of the rules of wrestling, is like, you know, you're wrestling, you're not brawling or fighting, but we've kind of lost that today where a punch really is, guys just punch routinely in matches, and then it's, you know, not, the refs don't try to really stop it. So,
right.
So at this point we have, Garvin runs into Flair. Flair lifts him up and kind of hits sort of like a hot shot, but instead of dropping his neck off the ropes, he slams his face into the cage. Looks really, really good. And then Flair covers, and Garvin is unable to. He kicks out right after the three, and then Flair wins the title. And then we have a really huge pop for the win. The crowd was really excited about that. And even Tony acknowledges that a lot of the fans were cheering. And then we have J.J. Dillon come out to celebrate with Flair. Not really. I didn't see any of the horsemen, at least the version that I saw. Maybe it cut off before the horsemen got out there, but it was definitely more of like a Flair being the triumphant, you know, return to, you know, becoming the champion again, and the belt with its rightful owner kind of thing. It just definitely felt like that, you know, more than, you know, the other way, which you might have expected it to.
You're right, because the Flair was certainly the heel at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and he would definitely, I mean, he would be the, you know, he was definitely, they're still in the thick of the horsemen. I mean, the horsemen have been around for a couple years now, and, you know, they're still, I mean, you know, he's the dominant bad guy. Well, dominant in a sense where he keeps the title, not really dominant in a sense where he, you know, wins by beating up people all the time. Because usually, you know, he would kind of either win by the skin of his teeth or get disqualified or so forth. I mean, this is a, you know, this is a clean win, kind of relatively rare for Flair, especially at this point.
By 87, Yeah,
so he would be another, he would be the villain for another year through 88, and then he would turn he would turn right after that, sort of in the midst of the feud with Steamboat. I think there's definitely some comparisons you can make with the Flair Garvin and the Flair Steamboat series. I mean, the Flair Steamboat ones I think are better, and Steamboat had, I mean, not only was able to really deliver like the tough looking offense, but he also obviously had more athletic gifts, you know, could come off the top, where Garvin, I mean, Garvin came off the top, but it wasn't like he was certainly not as graceful as Steamboat. But I think these, the way that these kind of were put together, I think there are definitely some similarities there. I guess probably the difference would be Flair Steamboat was more like, there was more like wrestling based, like, you know, kind of more mat work, kind of more working off like the headlocks and stuff like that, where with Flair and Garvin, it's a lot of them, you know, trading blows.
Sure. Yeah. And then again, that's more Garvin style as well, right? So just Flair,
adapting, you know, to that style.
Adapting to those styles, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, Flair is just fantastic at this point. I mean, he can pretty much do no wrong in the ring. I mean, it's, you know, what you can say what you want to say about the booking, but as far as, you know, Flair just really clicking on all cylinders. I mean, Flair in 87, you know, in 87, 88, 89 may have had better years than almost anyone else in the history of wrestling, at least, you know, North American wrestling, you know, and in the time period that we're aware of. I mean, obviously, wrestling has a long history of many places in many years, so, you know, maybe somebody could come up with something better. But as far as kind of the more modern era, it's hard to beat Flair during this time.
I would totally agree with that completely. I mean, you know, I'm a big Flair fan, and yeah, his matches have been, you know, incredible. So.
Yeah. Definitely, definitely. Any more thoughts on the match or wrestling during this era?
Well, the only thing I would say regarding this match is, you know, the build-up. There wasn't a whole lot of build-up that involved, that I could tell at this point, from Ronnie Garvin. It seemed more like Ric Flair, you know, cutting promos and building the match up. But I don't see a lot of Garvin.
Yeah.
In any of the videos, or I was wondering about that.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, probably a couple of things. One, Garvin wasn't the strong promo, so people aren't necessarily, say, you know, uploading his promos on YouTube like they would have for Flair. Also, yeah, you know, we talked about, you know, the sabbatical.
Prior to his September win in Detroit, you know, they had this whole big angle where, you know, they think Ronnie Garvin wrestling Arn Anderson. And, you know, the Flair interferes, the Horsemen interfere and beat up Dusty and Garvin, and it sets up that match in Detroit.
Right.
But there was none of those things happening, at least that I can tell, or that I even remember happening prior to Starrcade, which is interesting, right? Because it certainly would have painted Flair as more of the villain if they had more of that going into Starrcade.
Right.
I'm wondering if it was a decision, you know, because they wanted, you know, to kind of like have Garvin not be as popular and Flair being more popular for that effect, you know, going for the fans to go home happy at the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely possible. Garvin was 42 at this point, so he was a little bit older, certainly kind of, I mean, he's pretty much near the end of his career, because he lasted in NWA through like mid 88. In fact, he turned heel on Dusty, I think Great American Bash 88, and then right. I think he was gone by pretty much the end of the year. Yeah, he had a bit of an AWA run, and then yeah, WWF, he had a feud with Greg Valentine that was, although I liked the matches, but that was kind of a weird feud creatively, where it didn't really kind of seem to not really necessarily go anywhere. In fact, I think even Garvin lost a retirement match and then came back through some sort of shenanigans. Or
yeah, he became an announcer, like a ring announcer or something.
Oh, yeah.
I don't remember that period very well, because I wasn't really watching wrestling in the early 90s, but yeah.
Yeah, that was basically, yeah. I think they sort of, they appointed him as like a referee and like a troubleshooting referee kind of thing. And then he got involved with Valentine and was a special ring announcer at SummerSlam 89. And then eventually, I guess, eventually Valentine wanted Garvin reinstated so they could fight. And then that led to the Royal Rumble 90 submission match. And then Garvin won that to end the feud, and then they're and then kind of basically left after that. So I'm getting that from Wikipedia, but that jives with my memory as well. So I think Garvin is certainly somebody who people should, you know, he's definitely a good guy to seek out because he has a pretty interesting body of work, and he wrestled in a lot of places too. You know, that isn't, you know, I know in the early 80s in Georgia he was around. I mean, you know, he had some national TV stuff, so you don't think of him as being, you know, I mean, he was never really a big star other than this run, but he certainly, you know, he's certainly an interesting figure in wrestling to a, you know, to a certain extent. So.
Yeah, he had a long run, especially in the south, southeast of the U.S., I would more so than anywhere else. I mean, I don't think he wrestled much in Montreal, apart from that 85 run he had in the summer.
Which is interesting because he was born in Montreal. The fact that he, you know, didn't, interesting that he didn't really, wasn't really known for that.
His origins, I think, were downplayed. He's always billed from, you know, Atlanta, Georgia, or I think, yeah, primarily Atlanta, Georgia, never from Montreal that I remember anyways.
Yeah.
Maybe PWI would bill him from in their rankings and from Montreal. That's maybe how I first noticed him from Montreal. But yeah, I don't think he was ever billed from Montreal when he wrestled.
Sure. One of the things I've always had sort of interest in geography and where, you know, just kind of learning where places are. And I'm fascinated with maps and that kind of thing. And that actually started with wrestling magazines because I would see like the hometowns of where the wrestlers were listed. And I'd be like, oh, like One Man Gang is from Chicago. I wonder where Chicago is and what it's like. And so it's funny how that like led to me being not that I'm like a geography nut or anything, but that sort of led to an interest in that. So if people say that wrestling can't be edifying, I think they're wrong.
Right.
So, Rick, of course, thanks for being on the show. Appreciate you coming on. Very excited to have you on.
Well, thank you. I was happy to be on.
And, of course, everyone can follow you on Twitter at MaskedTweeter, which, you know, is one of my favorite wrestling Twitter accounts. Always enjoy your thoughts on things. And, of course, everyone, please check out WrestleSpective.com and FairToFlare.com. We have lots of podcasts and other good content up that you will definitely want to read. And keep checking out the Starrcade Main Event Series. We'll be having that periodically over the next few months as counting down to the 2000 show. There are some weak years in Starrcade, but it's definitely interesting things to talk about. So hopefully you will continue to enjoy that. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Let's be honest. Most wrestling websites suck. BS rumors, schoolyard gossip, plagiarism. It's no wonder why no one believes anything they read on the internet. Well, if you can't get something done right, you might as well do it yourself. Presenting the Fair to Flare Quarterly from the writers of FairToFlare.com and over a dozen other wrestling websites. We're not copy and pasting what we read in some newsletter. This is 100% original content from the best wrestling bloggers on the internet. In-depth analysis of the art of pro wrestling, debate, artwork, and humor. The Fair to Flare Quarterly will raise the bar of what wrestling journalism can and should be. Professionally edited and produced, and every contributor will be paid for their work. Order your copy of the Fair to Flare Quarterly today at FairToFlare.com. The better wrestling media has arrived.